something that can break down that fear?
I definitely think it's fear of the unknown, but I also feel like I don't even know half of my neighbors. People just don't talk to each other anymore. Exactly. And I was really, really inspired by my friend Dana Lynn Lewis's project, where that's really was the impetus, is wanting to get people to talk about homelessness, but also just talk about talking to each other and creating community.
Not a handout, a hand up.
Yeah. Thank you, I guess, and listen to another Right to Survive radio show. We'll be on next month, the second Wednesday of the month, from 6 to 7. And
tomorrow night we will be at Join from 5 to 7 p.m. if you want to come out and join us for our general meetings. Contact us at r2spdx@gmail.com.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
All right. It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world on Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland. Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world is a book release and talk by urban architect George Crandall. He'll discuss Portland growth, congestion, and global warming, and identify steps the community can take to shape an equitable and resilient Portland. Again, that's Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world, on Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, 147 Northwest 19th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio, a proud co-sponsor of Deconstruction, an evening of Japanese food and culture on Sunday, March 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Two Strokes Coffee Company in Portland. Deconstruction is an educational evening of Japanese food and culture benefiting the California Wildlife Relief Fund. The event features Yuri Baxter Neal, Yuhet Sato, Megan Dinto, and a traditional kasiki meal. It will not be vegan or vegetarian friendly. Again, that's Deconstruction, an evening of Japanese food and culture on Sunday, March 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Two Strokes Coffee Company, 8926 North Lombard Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next, Labor in Two, followed by Hard Knock Radio.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day Transport Workers Union Local 260 negotiated its first contract with the Pioneer Bus Company in Houston, Texas. It came after months of fighting to build an integrated union there. The local had learned the previous year that Pioneer was organized by an independent union that maintained Jim Crow bargaining units. The drivers, dispatchers, and shop employees union maintained separate and unequal bargaining units, one for white workers and one for black workers. They also had separate seniority lists, representation, and levels of promotion. The Transport Workers Union filed a petition with the National Labor Relations Board against the drivers' union. They demanded an election. The existing union argued that collective bargaining agreements already existed, which precluded any possibility of holding a new election for representation. The TWU pushed back. They contended that the contract bar rule could not apply to discriminatory agreements that divided workers along racial lines. The TWU also argued that it would be unconstitutional for the board to uphold Jim Crow contracts. The board agreed with the TWU and threatened to decertify the drivers union on the basis of racial discrimination. They concluded that where the bargaining representative of employees in an appropriate union executes separate contracts or even a single contract discriminating between Negro and white employees on racial lines, the board will not deem such contracts as a bar to an election. In the days before the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the board drew from Brown versus Board of Education to issue its ruling in December of 1962. The TWU won the election by a 3-1 margin and championed the end of Jim Crow at Pioneer.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
94.1.
What you see here is history. It's history. Never been done before. Never been done
in this country. In this country.
APFA.
To bring you to the light. Farewell to you, people.
What up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we're going to talk about some of the top issues of the day. We want to make sure you keep it locked. Do not turn the dial. All that and more coming up after the afternoon headlines.
Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this ain't your boy, this your brother, Ice Life.
And this M1 International, RBG all day, baby.
On Hard Knock Radio.
Word up.
Check it out, y'all.
Can I be the one to bring you joy?
What's up, y'all? This is Lettuce C with Hard Knock Radio.
News, views, and hip-hop. I, man, is Winston Bradley, a.k.a. Burning Spear, on Hard Knock Radio. Jai's real.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We wanted to start off our show on a somber note. Over the weekend, you know, Saturday night to be exact, there was a tragic killing that really reverberated with many here in the Bay Area. It is the death of a very talented, very well-known, very popular musician by the name of Victor McElhaney. He is the son of Lynette Gibson McElhaney, who is a city council member here in the city of Oakland. And for many people in the city, this is a tragedy that is just coming on the heels of a number of things. First, we just lost the passing of a social justice crusader, which is Jeff Adachi. So many people are still reeling with that. The month before last, we saw the death of Damani, who is a Damani Chad, who is the son of Kareem Chad, very popular radio DJ. His son was a producer. We did a show on that because that was touched 17 years old. And to lose Victor is just one after the other. Many of us here in the Bay are just, you know, besides ourselves. I wanted to talk to somebody who knew Victor. His name is Kev Choice, no stranger to our airwaves. But Kev is not just somebody who knew him. This was one of your students. So, Kev, welcome to the show. And how do we process this, you know, keeping in mind that so many people are dealing with tragedies all around the country and all around the Bay? But, you know, how do we kind of contextualize this passing?
You know, I feel like we're still trying to process it, and it's something that's very raw. Like I say, it just happened maybe a little over 24 hours ago. For somebody who was so dear to Oakland, our community, just as a young black man, also to be a musician who was so dedicated and passionate and giving so much, to see him develop from, you know, working in Oakland Public Conservatory, you know, I think he might have been in junior high school at that time, to see him graduate from OSA, one of the, you know, prize drummers at Oakland School for the Arts, you know, then go to Cal State East Bay studying music, and then go to further that to go to USC Thornton School of Music. Like, it's like the prime example of what we would want any of our music students to do, the path we would want them to take, to be able to study music, to be able to become a professional. He was working with groups like Soul Development or, you know, Elu J, or playing gigs around town. So to see that he was on the right path, that we dream our children, our youth, follow that path, take that path, go to the best institutions, follow your passion. And then to see his life taken short so senselessly, so uselessly, like, it's I haven't even come to fathom the circumstances of what happened yet. Like, I feel like we're still in mourning of just a loss of life. Like, we haven't even gotten into the what the hell really happened, and I feel like that's the next phase.
Right. Well, you know, the initial reports is that he, you know, he's on to school at USC, you know, studying music, a senior. And, you know, somebody who constantly, you know, like you all mentored him, but he in turn had started mentoring a lot of kids and was working with them, went to a store. And if he walked in the store, he walked in that store as it was being robbed. And what we now are experiencing and seeing more and more of is that it's just a different type of mentality now, where people are just like, you know what? You walked in, I'm going to kill you. And we're just seeing a real, I wouldn't say disdain, but it's like, I don't care about your life, I don't care about my life. A certain type of recklessness, a certain type of nihilism, right. You know, that to me, you know, it just speaks of desperation, desperate times, desperate people will do desperate and dastardly things.
Yeah, you know, and I, like I said, I'm still trying to fathom the loss and thinking about the circumstances of what would bring somebody, you know. And I also feel like when things like this happen, there's so many different reports, it's hard to say what happened. I mean, a robbery, yeah, we're saying, some people are saying it was a robbery, some people saying he walked in on a robbery, some people saying he got robbed. Like, when things happen like this in the streets, we don't really know the circumstances right now. So I'm it's hard for me to even go there. It's just dealing with the loss, trying to be available for the people that are mourning, trying to be available for, you know, Lynette and Clarence, his parents, his community, people that he, you know, his mentors like Angela Wellman at OPC, people at OSA. Like, we're mourning this right now, and then it's like getting into how to deal with what actually happened. But whatever it did happen, you're right, like a desperate person or somebody who needed some money or whatever the circumstances, it still doesn't validate the senseless taking of this precious life, this beacon of light for our city. So it's having me just go to a whole nother place about what does this really mean? Like, we work so hard to put our children, our young people on the right path, and then things like this could still happen. So it's like we got to do some real deep soul searching as a society, as a community, on how we're protecting each other. You know, I know even Lynette has been a proponent of more gun laws. You know, I myself, I feel like we need to do something to address these gun laws. We need to address the mental capacity of our youth or people who are dealing with hurt in communities, and how they're expressing that hurt, how they're dealing with hurt, because only a hurt person would go out and hurt somebody who they don't even know or unaware of, who hasn't hurt anybody in their life. You know, only somebody who's dealing with a lot of hurt or has been dealt with a lot of hurt, whether that be through society, whether that be through family, whether that be through any type of situation, would go out and feel like this is something that's justifiable to do over something so minor, something senseless as a robbery at a liquor store. So we gotta do some soul searching. We gotta be honest with ourselves about what are we doing to help heal each other? What are the images that we're putting out there? That's as musicians, that says activist, anything. Like, what is the messaging that we're putting out there? Are we putting out anger? Are we putting out love? And how is that, like you said, reverberating? Like, this type of thing is going to reverberate for a long time, because this was such a jewel of our community. In Oakland, people, when things like this happen, like, something's got to change. Like, we got to stand up and come together and support.
Let me ask you this. You know, we're talking about healing, and you work with a lot of youth over at OSA and other schools. Yeah. And so, you know, that becomes one battle in itself. How do you help, you know, the 13, 14, 15-year-old process this, especially since it's coming out of, you know, I mean, Victor McElhaney was at that school. Right. This is where he was raised, you know, people following his footsteps, and he's come back and spoken at that place.
Yeah.
So there's a strong possibility that these students that you teach mm-hmm. have gotten to know him and are definitely at the very least aware, if anything, because of, you know, the presence of his mom being a city council person.
Right.
But if I can walk you back, you know, you dealt with, you know, lost yourself in the form of Dewey, you know, whose name we should not forget, who is a very talented musician now with a part of your band, a drummer himself,
bass player,
I'm sorry, that's right, and, you know, senseless killing, mistaken identity on the freeway, you know, shot by some people who were angry, and they just kept driving, you know, and, I mean, how did you process that? Do you still carry that, and what do you... You know, what do you tell these kids who are now, you know, one of those many people when I go to a school and I go, how many of y'all, you know somebody who's died? And, you know, you go to a school in Oakland and you get more than half the people raising their hand. And that's not normal.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be normal. And anybody listening shouldn't think it's normal. They shouldn't say, oh, they live in the hood. It's Oakland, whatever. That's not normal. You know, death is not a part of life when it comes like this, you know. So what do we say to these folks, and how have you processed?
Well, it's deep because, on the first, you know, question of how do we deal with the youth right now, you know, I work at OSA where Victor was a student. And, you know, I think the first thing is just about creating space, allowing the students to grieve, allowing them to process, giving them hugs, giving them love, telling them, you know, that we're there for you. And also being vulnerable myself, like, as an adult, I can't be like, it's going to be okay, it's all right. Like, we're all processing this, no matter what age you are, or no matter what, you know, background you coming from, like, we're processing this together. And so, and just giving that space, like, let's talk about it, let's come together and play music, maybe let's just sit and cry, like, whatever it needs to happen, like, we have to just allow that, those raw emotions. Like, I broke down in my church yesterday just because I was trying to get through the service, trying to, you know, hold myself together, but maybe we need to cry, maybe we need to scream, maybe we need to be angry, but like allowing whatever emotion that is to come out of the youth, letting them speak, and just providing that space. How have I processed, you brought up Dewey Tucker, another situation that just left you questioning, how could something like this happen to somebody so gifted, so talented, giving so much, who meant so much to so many people. And we still processing that to this day. I'm still seeing friends. I'm still seeing posts. I'm still feeling like there's a part of my band that was missing that brought me to where I am today. Like, you know, he was an integral part of helping me come up doing shows when we was getting paid $20 and $30, you know. But it's those type of things, you never get over it. You never fill that void, and you just continue to try to, you know, move forward and process in whatever way you can.
You know, Saturday night, you know, Cesar Cruz and homies, you know, this program that he had, they had a gathering in East Oakland. And I had the opportunity, because they were talking about healing and all that other, you know, stuff that many youth are facing. And I got to see these young women speak that are still in high school. We're going to have them on later this week. But one of them broke down. She just broke down, and she was saying that she didn't understand why they were doing budget cuts, because she needed counselors, and she's not going to have her counselors no more.
Mm-hmm.
And she was sitting there just in tears, like, who am I going to talk to? Mm-hmm. Said the person that helped me, they're not going to be there no more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, like, you know, here we have this death that is reverberating around the city, And, you know, and we're trying to make sense. And now the kids, these kids that we say we love, these kids that are supposed to be, quote unquote, our future, what are the resources that's going to be for them? You know, because now we're seeing people go, well, you know, there ain't going to be no counselors, there ain't going to be conflict resolution in these schools. None of that is there. So I'm looking at it, you know, not to politicize it, but you got to look at it from that lens, because you are now charged with doing something that you aren't necessarily trained to do. Kev Choice, the musician, now has to figure out how to be the counselor, how to process your own grief, and make sure that some kids aren't sitting there, you know, when you go back to school this afternoon. You know, how's this, you know, it don't seem right. It just don't seem right.
But, you know, that's what, you know, us as community, that's what us as adults, we step into whatever position we need
but
to step
But
in.
The school is the community. The school, so that's what these people like was said, marching like, in.
The school is a community, but the school is an institution. You know, the school is an institution of people who are trying to, who are planning budgets, who are trying to, you know, make cuts. Like, so they're not, community is like, we're trying to deal with the people and what's best for the people. So I don't believe schools are, if schools are the community, they're going to do what's best for the kids. And we're seeing that they're not doing what's best for the kids. If you're going to cut restorative justice, if you're going to cut music out of schools, you're not doing what's best for the community. You're doing what a lawmaker is telling you to do, or somebody in a boardroom is telling you to do because of numbers and data. You're not looking at the feeling. You're not looking at the impact. So yeah, I wish schools were more community. And I work in a school, and I have to battle and fight, and I have to take it on myself to be like, you know what, there's a void that needs to be filled. There needs to be somebody talking to the black kids. There needs to be people talking to the brown kids. There needs to be somebody stepping in and raising our hands about how are we being involved in community at these institutions, which a school is an institution. So I mean, it's a crazy balance of trying to be a community member, trying to be somebody that a mentor, and also working under the institution of a school system. And that's a public school or charter school or whatever type of school you work in. It's an institution. So it's learning how to navigate that. Just like, you know, if you're a journalist, you're a human being, you're a parent, you work for a radio station, you got to deal with certain stuff on a radio station. Like, I'm an artist, I'm a teacher, I'm a parent, but I work at a school and I have to deal with that. So it's, I know that I woke up this morning like, people are hurting, you know, so connect with the teachers, connect with the students, see what they need, and then fill that void. This ain't a part of my job description. This is just what people in Oakland community I've seen do over years and years do, so I'm trying to help out in that way, you know what I'm saying?
And that's real talk, and that's very commendable and definitely needed. I just, you know, I just want people to think about, like, this should not be the norm. You know, you shouldn't have to do that. You are going to do it, but I don't want it to be expected, because as you're grieving, you are grieving. Kev Choice is grieving, right? This is somebody you knew, you know, in a different way. This is, you know, for lack of a better word, was, you know, one of those seeds that you help grow, you know, and you got to be on point, because now there are kids that you got to see who are going to be impacted by that, you know, that you got to hold it together when there's resources all around that aren't going to be devoted to our kids. And as you said, the cycle continues, you know, desperation breeds desperate action, oftentimes breeds malevolent, you know, malicious type of actions. It's all connected.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, it's just about trying to provide space, trying to fill voids, trying to be there for people. And like I said, I just want to give all respect and love and honor to Lynette and Clarence, the parents. You know, they're dealing with, I mean, it's unfathomable. I'm a parent.
And myself. Lynette just lost her grandson 2 years ago to almost the same thing.
Yeah, so we just got to send all of our love to them and support them in any way. And I'm pretty sure it's even delicate, even speaking about the death of someone's son, you know, in such a short amount of context. They're still dealing with processing it and doing all of the behind the scenes stuff for preparing for, you know, services and all of that. But I just feel like us as an Oakland community, we got to put everything aside. We got to put politics aside. We got to put differences aside. This is about a son of Oakland who was a bright rising star, who was doing the, who was on the right path, who was doing all the right things, who was a beacon of light to other youth coming up, who was a mentor after being a mentee. Now he's a mentor, giving back, coming back to the school. I'm at USC telling them about their experience, being an inspiration, and then for something like this to happen. So we gotta figure out a way to come together, heal as a community, love and protect each other as community, and figure out how to process this. So it's gonna take a lot, and I just hope that we all can figure out a way to come together and support each other.
Kev Joyce, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. Again, our condolences to the family of Charles and Lynette McElhaney, Clarence and Lynette McElhaney. You know, Lynette, of course, Oakland City Councilwoman. To her son, Victor, such a rising star. There's all kind of videos online of him playing in bands, Soul Development, Jennifer Johns. Fantastic Negrito, express those things. And everybody you talk to talks about what a talent he was, and just being the personification of, you know, the things that we say has put Oakland on the map. It's pure, unbridled, you know, raw talent that just, you know, it's transformative. And it's going to take a minute, you know, and hopefully they hear your words, Kevin, and step up to fill the void, and we learn to value life a little bit more, not less. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Goes out to all my peoples in the city, making ends meet, getting by, thinking about the hustle. Everybody struggles for the answer. Confusion will attack in a cold-blooded manner, but cancer kills my society. No need to lie to me. Real people fighting, always try to be correct with the mental and upright with the info. Catching hell, paying dues, but could it be so simple? The dark, cold planet, you can't take the drama. The worry, underprivileged, got the bulletproof armor. Surviving's just a job as they dodge caps daily. People going crazy, everyone who raised me. Thanks to my moms, and thanks to my pops. And thanks to the youth rowdy on the rooftop, who warned me of trouble, so son, get the bonus. I dedicate this to those who kept me focused.
To my brother Big E, yo, rest in peace. To the dead money makers, rest in peace. To my little cousin Sean, rest in peace. To the slain gang bangers, rest in peace.
Dedicate,
I gotta live in.
Dedicate,
I gotta live in.
Goes out to all my peoples locked down and waiting for the days to see the sun and the clouds. The stormy weather came, of course we ignored it. Praying for parole in prison, see the warden released from the pen. 8 to 10 on your feet, you're working, building, staying strong, watch the heat. Deceit lies snitching, you became a victim. The soldier quick on the phone in the kitchen. Nightmares and troubles, remembering the vision. Times is frustrating when nobody listens. Is this because they forget and regret to acknowledge one another? But all due respect to the veterans, experts, inmates in the cell. Keep your eyes on the prize, see you soon, wish you well.
To my brothers doing life, rest in peace. To my man known as Diz, rest in peace. To my brother called Capone, rest in peace. To all the lost souls, rest in peace.
Dedicate,
I got to live here.
Dedicate,
I got to live here.
Dedicated to the on the block, serving up those rocks and keeping knots. This is dedicated to the girls of the night. Rock on to the break of light. This is dedicated to the BMs, the Benz and the Jeeps, and the city that don't sleep. Dedicated, dedicated to the herb man smuggling.
Dedicated, dedicated.
Much love for Puerto Rico and my homeboy Tito.
this is dedicated to the sun, the moon, and the stars. Peace to all the gods. This is dedicated to music, and I'm on the hill and in the house. You know what it's about. This is dedicated to Gunsmoke, the 130 crew.
To Miss Rosa May, rest in peace. To the baby who's aborted, rest in peace. To my Uncle Papa, rest in peace. For those who lost their minds, rest in peace. Mr. Robert Munden, rest in peace. To the child in the drive-by, rest in peace. To the one called Stomper, rest in peace. To those who overdosed, rest in peace.
Dedicate,
I got to live, kid.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. All last week, we talked to you about a number of actions that were taking place in Sacramento. A lot of demonstrations, over 100 people arrested. And this was in the aftermath of the district attorney in that city declining to prosecute the cops that killed Stephon Clark almost a year ago. People pushed it up to the state attorney, Xavier Becerra, and he refused to press charges, which has resulted in more protests. We wanted to get an idea of what is happening and where things are headed. And on the phone line with us is Tanya Faison. She is with Black Lives Matter and up in Sacramento. And so, Tanya, welcome to the show. As I said, our listeners here in the Bay and other parts of the country were hearing bits and pieces about demonstrations. We saw that a mall was shut down. We saw that, you know, 80 to 100 people were arrested on a particular night. But we wanted to get the behind-the-scenes story as to what is happening and get updated as to what is happening with the case around justice for Stephon Clark.
Okay, yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me. We last year this time when we were protesting, and it was around the time that Stephon Clark was killed, because he was killed on the 18th of this month last year. It was mostly BLM leading, you know, BLM Sacramento. It was mostly us leading most of the protests and actions that were going on around that. This year, it seems like, you know, over the last year, a lot of people have started strategizing and organizing. So you have a lot of different groups that are doing different actions throughout the city. So when you saw the mall get shut down, that was shut down by the BSU at Sacramento City College. Those folks did that. And then there was a student march where all the students walked out at McClatchy High School and at Sacramento High School. And that was organized by folks at the BSU at Sac City College and then at the BSU at Sac State. And that was a youth march, and it was beautiful. And then we have organized, we spent 49 weeks at the DA's office. We were there every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And our plan was basically we're going to be here until you decide to charge these officers. She made an announcement on Saturday, and so we're no longer at the DA's, but we now are at the police station. So we're there every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. That's going on. And then on the one-year commemoration date, there will be a couple things happening. I know the family's holding some things that whole weekend, and then we'll be having a march on that night.
Let us walk back a little. You said this happened a year ago, and we had two officers that shot Stephon Clark in the backyard of his grandma's house. Who are the officers? Do we know their names? And who is the district attorney whose office that BLM, Black Lives Matter, Sacramento was occupying every Tuesday for the past year?
Yeah, every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So the officers' names are Robinette and Mercado. Those are the two officers. They're back on the street. I've actually seen Mercado on the street in my neighborhood where I grew up, which is a predominantly Black neighborhood. Then the DA that we've been, her name is Anne Marie Schubert. She's got a really close relationship with law enforcement in Sacramento. She's our district attorney. While we were out there over the last year, almost year, she decided to put a rent-a fence up around the whole place because she didn't want us on the grounds, even though we're taxpayers and we pay for that building to exist.
Wait, she put a razor fence up around her office?
A rent-a fence, yeah. So, yeah, she went ahead and ordered a fence, and it's been around her office since last April.
Wow. And why does she do that? I mean, it's not like you all were threatening her or anything like that. You're doing what many people have done over the years, is you protest and you push and you petition your elected officials to move in a direction that you feel is best for the community that you represent and come from.
For some reason, she's scared of us, and I don't know why. I mean, she went to the Board of Supervisors and asked for a bulletproof vehicle because she was in fear that she was going to get shot or something. But we were just out there. We've been taking up space. We're not even really camping. We barbecue. We barbecue every single day. We've made tacos and everything out there. We play music, and then we hold signs up. And since she's located downtown Sacramento, surrounded by a lot of lawyers and other offices of elected officials, we end up, you know, communicating with a lot of people and giving people information that they didn't know about Stephon Clark. So we did a lot of building in the area. We did a lot of getting out the vote in the area when the election time came. But yeah, I mean, that's all we're doing. I have no idea why she put a fence around. I know I'm not allowed to use the restroom in there either because I've asked before. They don't let us go in the building. We're not allowed on the premises.
Let me ask you this, Tanya. You know, over the past years, we've seen that BLM has been under surveillance by law enforcement, oftentimes mm-hmm. in a very secretive way. We've also heard rhetoric coming from police unions that suggested that Black Lives Matter, which is predominantly women, is somehow a threat that you all are going to run up there with weapons and start killing police officers. And we've heard rhetoric that suggests that BLM is at war with the police, suggesting that anytime an officer has been killed, it's somehow connected to BLM. Do you think the rhetoric and the actions taken by this district attorney is designed to create or to continue hysteria around the BLM organization, or is there something else at play?
I think that it's either one of two things. It's either that, you know, if she's doing it and she's being very strategic, or she's fallen for that rhetoric, that she, you know, looks at Black people and gets scared. There's no other reason for her to do this. I know. So this could go into a whole really long conversation. She's got a really close relationship with our sheriff department. Our Sacramento sheriff is Scott Jones. He has been going back and forth trying to, he's very racist. It's very blatant. He doesn't hide it. He's pretty well known. He sat at the table with Trump. He also did a Fox News piece against Obama when Obama was president. And he's got ties to different hate groups. He's just a really horrible person. But he does the same thing. Whenever we have actions, if he feels it's personal to him, he'll send people out. He'll hype it up and act like we're criminals or we do criminal things. I've never broken the law. I've gotten speeding tickets. That's about as bad as it gets with me. We don't advocate violence. We don't act violently. But that rhetoric is dangerous and it's real, and the surveillance is real. And as a result of the rhetoric, you know, we get a lot of hate thrown at us and we get a lot of violence thrown at us. So that's how it ends up playing out.
Can you describe, you mentioned that you have a sheriff that is blatantly racist and has ties to Trump and the alt-right and other groups like that. What has it been like living in that area that is patrolled by a sheriff that has that type of vitriol that you know, I've heard not just from you but from others, that is directed at the Black community? What options do you have to protect yourselves from this sort of individual and the policies that he puts forth?
So I, first of all, make sure I don't live in the county jurisdiction. I live in the city jurisdiction so that he, you know, I don't have to deal with the sheriff's department as much as possible anyway. It is, this sheriff has, he is very blatant. He doesn't comply with anything. You know, in this age where police violence has been highlighted and people are talking about it and people are fighting it, you have different police departments and they might, you know, they'll do things to pacify the public, like wear body cameras or hire a more diverse, you know, police department. They'll do little things that aren't really big steps in change, but they want it to look like they do. He's so blatant with it, he's like, I'm not getting body cameras. I'm not releasing videos. I don't want to deal with the backlash of releasing videos like the Sacramento Police Department has to deal with. So he is very blatant about oversight. He's against it. At some point not too long ago, I'm sorry, in 2015, he chose to have an inspector general. He helped to pick who that would be, and he chose a man named Rick Brazil, who was part of SAC PD for 30 years. He's been part of the California Peace Officers Association. They both were president at some point in time. So they have a relationship with each other. So he chose him. And last year, I'm sorry, 2017, Michael McIntyre was killed by SAC Sheriff. So Rick Brazil was, you know, he did what he's supposed to do. He investigated it. And instead of always complying and saying the police are not, you know, they should have feared for their life and going along with that narrative, he decided to actually be honest this one time with Michael McIntyre, and he came out and said that the police did not have to fear for their life and that the force was excessive. And so when that happened, Scott Jones locked him out of his office. He tried to fight letting him back in through the Board of Supervisors. Luckily, the people won because we went there and made sure that we had our voices heard. And so Rick Brazil was let back in his office, and the inspector general position still exists. But that's the kind of man we're dealing with. He thinks that he's very power hungry, and he thinks that he is above the law. And so, he doesn't hide it. So,
where does the attorney general, Xavier Becerra, stand on all this? That's why we elect an attorney general. And prior to that, you know, you had people like Kamala Harris sitting in that seat. What role has he been able to play to rein in a sheriff that has this sort of attitude? One would think in a solidly blue state like California, remember in this state, President mm-hmm. Trump lost by 4.5 million votes. So that goes to show you, if we're looking at it in terms of, you know, left and right politics, this leans to, you know, what is described as the left. How has this attorney general been responding to the complaints and concerns voiced about the sheriff?
So I know that in the recent months that there were people that specifically sat down, I want to say the NAACP here in Sacramento, sat down with Becerra and told him that he needs to get the sheriff out. And I don't know, I know that his response was either small or nothing, because there was no action done after that. I know that he doesn't seem to take a strong stance against any of the actions of law enforcement in Sacramento, and he works right here. He's from SAC. And I don't know him personally. I've never sat down with him, so I don't know him personally. I know that I did sit down with DOJ when they did some type of investigation on SAC PD that was requested by SAC PD on how they can strengthen, you know, their use of force policy and things like that. But I have never heard Becerra take a stand against the sheriff. I've never seen him flex his power at the sheriff or even act like he, you know, if you don't stop, I'm going to do this. And then as of late, I know he's been in the news for because SB 1421 passed, and now people are requesting for documentation from our police agencies, and a lot of agencies are not giving it out. Apparently, one of the agencies did give it to some journalists, and the SARA is now trying to get that information back from them. He doesn't want them to have it. So I think his actions show us what side he's on. When he gave his announcement, he's very soft-spoken. He seemed very humble. He seemed kind, but he still gave the same announcement that D.A. Schubert gave. And it's still based on a very subjective and problematic use of force policy. But he hasn't taken any big stand, and he hasn't really done anything for the people. And in California, being a Democrat and voting Democrat doesn't impact law enforcement, because a lot of our Democrats in the Capitol are pro-law enforcement, and that's why it's so hard to get legislation passed, real legislation.
So we have a brown man, Xavier Becerra, who's basically the top cop in the state of California. Sacramento PD, which is responsible for the shooting of Stephon Clark, made history when they put a black police chief by the name of Daniel Hahn in charge. How has he been, considering the neighborhood in which Stephon was shot, considering the makeup of the protests, considering the long history of complaints and concerns that have been registered? Here you have a black police chief. What has been his response to that black community?
You know, when he first became chief, I actually felt sorry for him, because I thought, you know, Sacramento keeps killing black people, and he's going to now be the face that has to deal with it. And so it makes it look like it's less about race for those that want to use that. But then I kind of watched him, and he's very arrogant. He is loved by a lot of the black community that's not in touch with what's going on. A lot of the older black folks, so they did. Now they're starting to see him. He has refused to give people answers. There's been city hall meetings, city council meetings, where he's been present, and families of people that have been killed by law enforcement, his police department, are present as well. And he'll spend his whole time like looking at his phone, and people will say, "Get off your phone," and he'll roll his eyes. He just is really arrogant. He hasn't done any changes. We've had three policies that have been created since Stephon Clark. One of them is the body cam policy, where it can't turn off or get muted. Another one is the foot pursuit policy, where police are not supposed to chase people now. And then the last one is less lethal forms of force. But all three of these policies have no repercussions attached to them. So these policies exist for these rules to be followed, but there's nothing in it to say, if you don't follow these rules, these are the consequences. And when they killed Darrell Richards on September 6th, which is another young black man, he was only 19, he was killed in someone's backyard by SACTV. They violated two of those policies. They didn't give less lethal forms of force. They didn't use pepper pellet guns or any tear gas or anything. And then they also, their body cam went off just mysteriously. Their SWAT, they have this shield around all four of them. It's one big shield that they hold in front of them. But somehow, one of the officers, the one who had a clear view of Daryl, that they said they accused him of having a gun and pointing it at them. And then later they said it was a pellet gun, which I don't believe he had any gun. But that camera that would have shown this mysteriously went off. So both of those policies were violated, no consequences. And so we still are back at square one, and we're not going to see any change. So this police chief, he's a spokesperson. He's the black face of the department. He always touts the fact that he grew up in Oak Park, which is a predominantly black neighborhood. I grew up there too, and I don't know him, or I didn't know him. And, you know, I just think all of these things are pacifications, and they don't work. And people are learning, but they're learning the hard way.
Right. You know, Daniel Hahn, the police chief of Sacramento, proudly claims, you know, when he speaks, that he's made at Sac State, you know, to tout that he's a local homegrown product. But obviously there are large segments of the community that have been protesting that do not feel that there's a connection between him and the actions that are taking place on the ground that are impacting folks. With that being said, We had a legislative victory last year with the passing of the bill that would allow folks to get a police record, which you say is being vigorously fought. And the reason for getting these police records, which would be a weakening of the policeman's Bill of Rights, is so that you can find officers and see if there's a pattern in their behavior. Up to now, we didn't know if an officer, you know, Officer Joe, had a history of violence, or if, you know, if he's caught on camera or there are complaints registered against him, if it's just an aberration, just a one-time thing. Now we have this bill to change the policies around lethal force, and it looks like almost every police union is fighting this. With that being said, you all are in Sacramento, and you all are there to see the lobbying around these bills, pro and con. What's it been like for BLM, and what would you tell our listeners with respect to, you know, pushing and crafting a legislative solution to any of this?
So with that bill, the new one, AB 392, some of the chapters in BLM have signed on to it. It's a disclaimer, I'm putting that out there. Our chapter personally, we're not for it or we're not against it. The bill itself, it basically changes the use of force policy, but it still includes the self-defense option inside of it. And it states what an officer has to do before using lethal force, and it's really manipulatable, and I don't even know if that's a word, but I keep using it for this because it's easily manipulated. It's like you have to yell out, you know, a warning, and then that's when you can kill somebody. And there's no time frame in between those two things. So, you know, I mean, just like they yelled gun with Stefan before the word gun was even out of their mouth, they were shooting. So, and then there's, you know, on top of that, it doesn't have any types of consequences if it's not followed. So you've got this new legislation. Say it goes to our district attorney, who loves Scott Jones, who's our sheriff. They've got this best friend friendship, and she decides that she's not going to comply with this use of force policy, but she's going to continue to treat it like we're on the old use of force policy. She can do that and get away with it, and there's nothing that will happen. There's no requirements on it. So that's why I mean, I'm glad that legislation is being made, but, you know, and I understand that at the Capitol, it's really hard to pass legislation, so they do move in small increments when they do create bills to, you know, so that they will pass. But we're not, our chapter isn't really lobbying for it like a lot of organizations are doing on the ground out here, pushing it and saying it at every march. We're not doing that because it's not really that strong in our opinion.
Is there a possibility of getting rid of the district attorney, Anne-Marie Sharbert, or did she just get reelected?
She just got reelected, and we are going to be doing recall efforts for Scott Jones. And now that this decision has come out the way that it has and the way that she delivered it, we are adding her to our recall efforts, and other organizations are joining us. And so we will be pushing to recall her from office.
How is she able to get reelected in the aftermath of Stephon Clark being shot? Where is their support, and is there a strategy, or is there something that people listening should be doing? Because obviously, as you said, this police chief manages to ingratiate himself in the eyes of older black folks, meaning that he may go to some of the churches and go with some of the older organizations and make promises that they find acceptable. And it sounds like that similar strategy is used with the district attorney, that she's able to go to particular communities and ingratiate herself the same way that we saw Nancy O'Malley down here in Alameda County. But are there staunchly conservative areas in Sacramento that outnumber the communities where folks are impacted by their policies?
Personally, I think that, so in Meadowview, for example, and this is the neighborhood where Stephon Clark was killed, Schubert won overwhelmingly. I think she got 62 or 65% of the vote in that neighborhood alone. And honestly, the only reason that could have happened is because she had signs up everywhere. I don't think people are becoming informed with what's going on, especially when it comes to local local government. And so you have people, it seems like people are voting just on name recognition. I mean, it really feels that way because you've got organizations getting out the vote. Like, a lot of people were informing people. We were out there, and we didn't expect Scott Jones to win, and he won by, like, maybe 1%. So, yeah, I think it's just a matter of folks being informed on the issues and wanting to be informed and wanting to be involved and digging deeper than just, okay, this person was killed and these police didn't get charged, but, you know, who's in charge of that? Who's in control of firing the police, and who has the power to charge these officers, and what does that process look like? A lot of people aren't educated on those things, and I think it's reflecting in our election. That's my personal opinion, though. Because she's not embraced by any community but the ones that she actually looks like. I've never seen her go to anything that's, you know, run by a black organization. Not even a black organization that is older and more respectable. I haven't seen any of that with her. I know she's supposed to be getting an award in the near future at some Chamber of Commerce meeting. I see her just going off name recognition alone. She had huge signs everywhere. They were at our city college. They were everywhere in black neighborhoods, white neighborhoods. So it's that money. She's able to put that out there, and she was able to win.
As we close out, what would you ask our listeners to do, Tanya? They're listening. They're frustrated. They're befuddled. What are two or three things that you would ask people to do moving forward?
I just think people need to stay alert to what's going on. It's here in Sacramento, like, keep your ears open. Y'all aren't that far away from us. If you could drive down here, then make that trip. The more bodies that we have out here, the safer we are. And sometimes we don't have that many bodies with us. And that's when we end up getting 84 people arrested at one action. Amplify, if you can't come out, then just put the word out so that maybe somebody you know will come out. And then if that's not, if those things aren't possible, then help out by donating. Our website is incitaction.com, and that's spelled like inciting violence, I-N-C-I-T-E, action.com. But just staying in the know and getting the news out so that it continues to reach as far as possible. And don't stop talking about these deaths. Since Stephon Carte, in 2018 alone, 5 people died in Sacramento by police shootings, and 4 of those people were black and unarmed. So this is happening in our city every 2 to 3 months. Nobody looks at us like they do Ferguson. Because we are a political city and a very professional city, and we're in California. Everything looks pretty, like, you know, everything is beautiful out here and everything's running smoothly. But our local officials, and our state officials, there's not a lot of change happening, and there's a lot of lip service, and there's a lot of people getting away, a lot of police getting away with killing people. This chapter has existed since the very last month of 2015. And we are fighting for 12 people in the city alone.
Well, there you have it.
Keep the word going.
There you have it. That is Tanya Faison from Black Lives Matter Sacramento. This weekend, there will be a lot of activities as they come up on the one-year anniversary of the shooting death of Stephon Carte. There will be a lot of activities commemorating this. And then on Monday, there will be a huge march. Am I right about that?
That is correct. We're having a march to commemorate Stephon Carte. He was killed on the 18th, so on the 18th we'll be marching for him. We'll be starting at the Lightwell Station in Meadowview and walking to Meadowview Park, and then we'll have somewhat of a vigil to remember him. And that's following a weekend full of events that the family is holding as well. So that weekend will be a really busy weekend. The march is going to be huge. We've already got a lot of people saying that they're going, so... And we'll be in a black community. Hopefully folks will come outside and join us.
Tanya, thank you so much for taking time out this afternoon. We're going to take a break on Hard.
KBOO is looking for a grant team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a 1-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO development director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
Hello, this is Susan Cecil, and I love KBOO. Do you love KBOO? Call us at 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us why you love KBOO. We'll use the audio during our upcoming spring membership drive. It takes the community to support the community radio station, KBOO! Yay! The number again, 503-231-8032, extension 302. This has been Susan Cecil for KBOO Portland, signing out. Bye! Hello! This is Susan Cecil, and I love KBOO. Do you love KBOO? Call us.
You are tuned to KBOO at KBOO Portland.